This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Never underestimate unique content.
Who knows the true meaning of Easter?
The consumer doesn't realise that they have 50 grams down.
I still say that the best deal I've ever done in my life was figuring out how to get out of that mess.
It is Monday, the 8th of January, 2018. Welcome to a brand new year and welcome to a brand new Simon Dell Show. Now, today we have got a gentleman by the name of Mike Boyd, who is based in Singapore and is the CEO of a company called Vroom Vroom Vroom. And you can look them up if you like, vroomvroomvroom.com, spelt V-R-O-O-M, as it sounds. They are a car rental company, one of those ones that goes and gets you the best deals from all the car rental companies. And that company is actually, as we'll find out, 17 years old. Can you believe it? It is a digital startup business. Well, it's not a startup, 17 years old, but it's a digital business that is 17 years old, founded in 2001 in the midst of the dot-com crash. It is an absolutely fascinating conversation with Mike. He's done some jobs since he was at university, which are equally fascinating as to what he's actually doing now and the stories behind those jobs, how he got to where he got to and how he grew those businesses. So it's a fantastic interview, definitely worth tuning into. We'll also jump into our Spin Cycle segment in a minute. And finally, I just want to do the usual thank yous, of course, to Gilberto, who is the unsung hero of this entire podcast, and stitches this thing together like nobody else could. If you want to follow us, we are on Instagram, The Simon Dell Show. If you've got any questions, you can contact me through my website, simondell.com, or email me at simon@simondell.com. And you can find me in all the other usual places on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, etc., 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 except Snapchat, because I've never really got Snapchat. I don't understand it. And I have no intention of understanding it now. So please, finally, if you get the chance, go on to iTunes and give us a rating or review. If you can't be bothered to write a review, and I know how stressful that can be, please just go on there and give us 5 stars. So let's kick on with this week's episode of The Spin Cycle. We are back. It is 2018. It is a new year and a new edition of the Spin Cycle. And with me, as usual, is the I've been thinking about this one, is the fireworks and glass of champagne at midnight on New Year's Eve, the professor from QUT, Dr. Edwina Luck.
Woohoo!
And also the 3 a.m. taxi queue. Long taxi queue of co-hosts is Patrick Condren.
How kebab are you? Eating?
Kebab dribbling on here, shirt.
Yes. Special sauce all down your shirt.
How is it that on a night at 3 a.m., drunk as the Lord, it's a kebab, but during the day it's a gyros?
No,
when you're not drunk.
I've never eaten either of them. Any time of the day.
So. Do yourself a favour.
You're missing out.
Do yourself a favour. Get down to the Euros shop and get yourself one.
Definitely. It is.
They are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they will not get the Heart Foundation tick, but they. From the last photo I've seen of you, Simon, it doesn't appear you care anymore.
No.
That's
I just want to start off. Just on that note, I want to start off because I had a coffee with a friend before Christmas. I do have friends, believe it or not, and he actually asked me, he goes, he didn't realize who Patrick Condren was.
What do you mean?
He'd listened to the podcast and he didn't realize who Patrick Condren was.
What I
think it means is that we didn't ever do a good enough job explaining who you are and what the hell you're doing here. So just for everybody's benefit, Patrick is a highly notable reporter and journalist.
Notable. Award-winning is usually the prefix.
Have you won an award?
A Walkley Award, absolutely.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
Absolutely.
How long ago was that?
Yes. I've grown a beard since.
For Channel 7, aren't you? And you do all
yes,
the
I
politics,
do politics
on,
yes.
on the TV. And if you're lucky enough to watch him on TV, he's highly entertaining. So that's pretty much Patrick Condren for anybody who didn't know that. So
can I just say that's a fairly abridged version? I'm much more.
I could have gone on for an hour at least.
Oh, easily.
But for everybody's benefit, easily. Maybe we like to just skip into your story for today.
They can always Google it. I'm just finishing off. I'll come back to that thought. I'm just finishing off the first of my hot cross buns that I purchased at Coles. I think it was today.
No.
And can I say? What a godsend it was. There are zero left in the packet of six. Finbar's eaten three, toasts them, slathers them in butter.
Oh,
I had one
yes.
this afternoon myself. It's fantastic. And as I said to the young lady who was putting it through the checkout, excuse me, as I said to the young lady as she was poking it through the checkout, if we can have fruit all year round because of hothouses, why can't we have hot cross buns?
Mm-hmm.
And she smiled politely. She's a top shiller, Bruce, and not at all stuck up. It's fantastic, and I think we should. Christmas has lost all its religious meaning these days. It's just a money grab by people who want, bigger, better, more expensive. You know, Easter. Who knows the true meaning of Easter? Why can't we have hot cross buns on January the 1st? On January the 1st, the only thing I'm cranky about is that the shops weren't open on January the 1st, so I couldn't get them
shops,
then.
My shops I went to were open on January the 1st.
Did you get me some hot cross buns?
No, I actually didn't even look for them, but I love them too.
I didn't have to look. They were there right in your face.
I do love them, and they should be around all year because I actually freeze mine from Easter weekend. I put like a heap in the freezer already cut so I can just toast them. Mm. But I agree with you, Pat. I mean... the meaning, it's more about consumerism and buyism rather than what it actually are we celebrating.
So I've got a theory on you. I've got a hot cross bun theory for you, Pat.
Oh, this will be good.
Now, what I reckon is that everybody now makes a joke about the fact that hot cross buns are in the stores as soon as Christmas is over.
Absolutely. And all the talkback radio that's on at the moment,
absolutely,
they are desperate for content. So
it's an easy win. It's an easy win
absolutely.
To get in the media
absolutely.
For Coles and Woolworths.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's all it is.
You can buy sausage rolls all year round. Why can't you buy hot cross buns?
Well.
And we're talking about it. I mean, the dozens, millions of people that listen to this podcast, people talk about it. So why wouldn't you? I mean, it would be stupid not to pick up on that sentiment and try and monetize it.
So where do they go next year? If it's the 2nd of January.
Yes.
And they wanted to play that hand of cards that they've got hot cross buns in the store.
Mm.
Do they go even earlier? Do
yes,
we
they
start
do.
Seeing
no,
them
no.
on
Boxing Day
sales?
They do.
If I was them, I wouldn't stop.
I don't know why they don't. They're such
I
a
would just
seller.
Keep going.
Because then they won't have the opportunity to get themselves in the media on the 2nd of January.
They will, because if they keep selling them, then the media starts talking about why haven't they stopped selling them.
Mm-hmm. But they'll only do it once and then
of course.
At least
they will.
By stopping and starting, they can then, you know, each year they can make a big deal about it. And
I guarantee you, people will buy hot cross buns regardless of when they're in the shops.
What do you reckon, Eddie?
In terms of marketing.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry. I do beg your pardon, Professor.
Team
doctor.
Champagne.
Do you call it a doctor or professor? We're 13 episodes in. We really should know that.
She's not really a doctor.
I am, but I'm not a professor.
She's not a doctor of hot cross buns.
No, well, that's right. See, the thing
I haven't seen a hot cross buns. I don't know what you're talking about.
We've seen a lot of brands do this over the years. It's basically looking at bringing out a product. Smith's Chips did this, and they brought out double cheese and big red tomato sauce, and Coke Lime. They only bring out certain products for a certain amount of time. So it creates buzz, but it also creates hype, and you have to have it now. And also Kmart have done this strategy, used this strategy really well, because they only have so many units. And if you're in the Kmart club, and I know we've gone from Hot Cross Buns to Kmart, but, you know, if stores, and whether you're listening to this in America, maybe it's another store that you know, and it's they only have a certain line for a certain amount of time. They have a really hot, strong promotion on it, and you get in, you get out, and the store that makes the money, and then they move on to the next one. So it's a must-have.
The Broncos burger at one of the fast food joints.
Mm-hmm. I'm still waiting for the McRib to come back.
The McRib, absolutely. Toothbrushes. A toothbrush. I feel sorry for the people that make toothbrushes because it's a toothbrush. It brushes your teeth. You put toothpaste on it and you rub it across your teeth. They're constantly having to find new ways to say, here's the new latest toothbrush. Ta-da!
Well, imagine if you were poor old Salt.
Yeah.
Although it's made a resurgence, really. Himalayan.
I think Salt has an image issue in terms of heart hardening the arteries, et cetera, that it will struggle to overcome.
Yeah.
Well, actually, and while we talk about that, then got fined last year was Nurofen. Because Nurofen were struggling to come up with products that kept them relevant, because at the end of the day, you either took your Nurofen if you had a headache, or you didn't take your Nurofen. Mm. And then they started coming up with all those variations, one for period pain and backache, which essentially was exactly the same thing.
Well,
in a different colour box.
Exactly.
Very clever.
It wasn't clever.
Five millions of dollars for it, so it wasn't that clever.
It wasn't that clever. Anyone with half a brain sitting down, one of the few people that sits there and watches free-to-air TV, would go, hang on. How does it target the pain? Yeah.
How does it know where it's going?
How does it know? That's what I said to Margaret. We're sitting there watching. Back in the days when we watched free-to-air TV, I said to her, and she's medical, I said, well, how on earth does it, and I cannot repeat what she said in response.
It's like a homing pigeon. It goes towards the pain.
It doesn't.
No.
And that's why they get fined millions of
Actually, and I think my wife suggested to me 4 weeks ago that you can actually join. There's a class action suit against Nurofen now, which you can join, and you can join it by doing a signed affidavit to say that you purchased one of those products and you felt disgruntled and blah 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 blah. And there's a chance that you could win a portion of millions and millions of dollars off Nurofen. Anyway, so my last question on the hot cross buns issue is then, does this mean, Patrick, that you would be eating hot cross buns on grand final night if they were available?
Yes, I would be eating hot cross buns on grand final night. I would eat them every night of the week if I could. And that's because of marketers and advertisers who have convinced us, who have told us that we can have what we want when we want it.
Hey, we're not evil.
I hadn't finished there, Professor. And it's even worse in America, because if you don't get what you want when you want it, you will take legal action to get it. Yeah. And Australia is heading in that direction as well. So why shouldn't we have hot cross buns when we want them? My kids get whatever they want whenever they want it.
Is your local Coles or Woolworths? Which one do you shop
at? Six or one, half a dozen, the other. Whichever's I'm closer to at the time.
Anyone who lives near Patrick Condren, you've got a guaranteed market of hot cross buns there.
Correct.
365 days a year.
Correct. But then again, what sort of hot cross buns do you want?
Maybe we should just move on from the hot cross buns.
Do you want the traditional fruit? Do you want chocolate ones? There's chocolate ones.
Anyway, Eddie, what's your story for this?
Well, speaking of pain, Victorians who want to go to the movies, and they've had a bit of a heat wave over Christmas, they have a lot of cinemas have been slammed because they've trialled dynamic pricing. Now, we've seen dynamic pricing by Coca-Cola vending machines when...
Is that a clever word for...
Surge pricing. How about
gouging?
Gouging, absolutely. So when the weather is really hot, Coca-Cola put up the price of Coke in their vending machines. We see Uber taxis. Uber, I shouldn't call them Uber taxis. Ubers do exactly the same thing. Taxis are also considering to do that. But movie theatres have never done this before. And they're doing it on, obviously, their busy nights of Friday, Saturday. But not only are they charging more for the movie, they are charging more for ice creams and the candy bar, should I, you know. So
Could they yeah, charge
whoa,
more
whoa,
for
whoa, whoa, whoa,
could
whoa,
they
whoa,
charge
whoa,
more
whoa.
For ice cream and candy bars?
Yes, it's always, they do.
You always have to get a mortgage out to pay for ice cream and candy in a
I know, and popcorn. It costs a fortune. Imagine now. I mean, I know people who sneak in stuff, but popcorn, I mean, we all love a Choc Top. But now they're charging an extra 50 cents, possibly even a dollar.
Surge pricing on Choc Tops.
I know.
That's un-Australian.
I'm going to lose my temper. Hang on. You with an English accent cannot say it's un-Australian having uttered candy bar in the previous sentence.
Oh, he can.
It's not. They're biscuits. They're lollies.
Well, lolly bar. Lolly bar. We don't call it a lolly bar.
God's sake, get on with the story.
Do you want some lolly?
It's
we don't have candy.
It's a great tactic that has been used and has been slammed by Uber.
Okay. I've never heard of it before.
You've had a surge pricing in Ubers.
Oh, in Ubers I have, absolutely.
Yeah but so but now the surge pricing
not
in popcorn.
Movies.
No, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy,
absolutely.
And
what
isn't
makes
it?
Them think they can get away with it?
Well, if it'll be very interesting. The trial goes for a month, which of course
it's only
is
a trial.
But this is the perfect month to do it. This is school holidays, people are bored, or people want to go into air conditioning. People also, there's a lot of movies coming out as well now.
None of them any good.
Well, but people are still going because they want something.
Oh, sure.
I personally think cinemas are struggling for attendance because people are going, why would I spend that amount of money on a ticket and then get gouged in the candy or sweet or whatever you want to call it bar, and when I can wait 3 months and sit at home with, you know.
No, I think
totally
you're wrong.
Agree,
I think you're,
Simon. Totally agree.
I disagree emphatically because people predicted the end of the movies.
The newspaper.
If she'd let me finish one thought. People predicted the end of the movies when videos came out. And it didn't happen. And in fact, more people are going to the movies these days because it's a different and it's a better experience, evidenced by the gold movie passes that you can buy and enjoy a glass of wine with the movie.
True, and
and it's on
in
the
a
big
lot of
screen.
Cinemas.
Mm. And until the TV screens catch up to the size of the big screen, I mean, there's some movies that have to be seen on the big screen. Yeah. But I agree. There are other times when you can sit at home and watch a good movie. But I don't think they do. I don't think the movie proprietors do themselves any favors at all by gouging for a Choc Top for what is part of the experience.
That's the thing. It is, and you've got to look at that whole augmented product. You've got to have a look at what it entails. Getting to the movies, you know, parking is expensive, or you have to take the bus, or what, you know, it's
well,
a big deal.
I have to catch a bus to the movies. I'm not going to the movies.
Well, a lot of people do, and then you go and eat there, and you know, where if you go to a shopping centre, then you've got to look at the 3-hour parking time limit. So there's a lot of other factors, and going out for a family. Okay, we're only talking price gouging of an extra, say $10, but that added on is rude.
I'll actually give you some. We'll give some facts here because we should actually.
First time for everything.
Well, exactly. the attendance rate, the percentage of Australians that have been to the cinema in the last 12 months has been pretty flat since 2000. I'm looking at a graph here. It hasn't changed much. In fact, in the 50 plus age group category, it's actually grown. It's grown by sort of about 5-10% in the last 12 years. What seems to be declining when you look at these numbers in the same sort of time period is the frequency. So the average number of visits per year within those particular categories. And for example, the 14 to 24 year olds has dropped by, you know, from I think it's about 10 visits a year to about 8 visits a year. And the others seem to be in slight decline. So I think there is it's pretty static. I don't think there's a terminal decline yet.
I don't think. Well, in our lifetime, there'll always be a place because it's a wonderful experience, but it is a half a day. Do you think movies are a lot longer now?
Like starting to gouge people for pricing, for surge pricing on your box of popcorn, surely that's not doing anything to encourage people to come back more quickly.
Exactly.
The interesting thing is there is a law and it's just noticeable difference. And if we went to Coles and we actually looked at the hot cross buns that we bought last year, the amount of grams probably has gone down by 10 or 20 grams. Now, because we don't know, we don't know. And this happens with bread. It happens with baked beans. You know, the tin stays.
It's got a specific name. It's called something like reverse inflation or something like that because it's a way that companies can put their prices up without actually putting their prices up, if that makes sense.
Exactly. So the consumer doesn't realise that they have put the amount of grams down. But unfortunately, what the movie guys should have done was why not put their popcorn up by 5 cents? You know, they charge a fortune. Like I'm looking at the price here, $8 for a small popcorn, a Choc Top, $5.20. But you can buy
1.5 punnets tubs of ice cream for that.
That's right. But absolutely. You only buy it 8 times a year if you're 14 to 24. And if they put it up to $5.50, the kids would pay it or, you know, the people would pay it. Exactly. So, you know, do be smart about this.
Having spoken to people in the cinema industry a couple of years ago, the feeling that I got from them is that they actually don't care much for the, what's the best way of describing it? The cheaper end of the marketplace. So those people that are coming in on a budget, they just don't really, they're not concerned about attracting them. What they are concerned about is attracting the people that are willing to spend, you know, let's say $15, $20 on a ticket or $40 if you go in gold class, and then they're going to punt another $20 on, they want those and they want them coming back more frequently. So everything they're doing, aside from the surge pricing, which I still don't understand, is trying to attract those people back again. What they don't want to do, by the sounds of this, is they don't want to start offering discounts. They don't want to sort of get into that, you know, Harvey Norman forever discounting cycle.
But I would say that it would be the normal Joe Bloggs going to the movies. They'd be the normal people.
But they want the normal ones that are prepared to drop $100.
Well, they should market to them. Yeah. You know, they should market to them instead of giving them, well, anyway, some cinemas do and do it very well.
On that note, my story for this week is something similar because it's an industry or a media industry that is not in decline, that hasn't been affected by disruption. But there was a story this week about they believe that that radio, and obviously we all know radio, that radio is going to be the next industry that's going to suffer a terminal decline. And that's because of the cars that people are driving, is that people are driving older cars with older radios in them. And as they start to upgrade in the next 2, 3, 4 years, they'll upgrade to cars with better radios and digital radios and podcast streaming things in their cars and stuff like that. So
absolutely.
Do you absolutely. My question for you guys is whether you feel that the radio is on a cusp of disruption and whether that disruption will be positive or negative for it.
Well, I think radio is the great survivor. Having worked a bit in radio myself, I think it's the great survivor, but it does have significant challenges ahead of it because of the digital technology. I know that some afternoons, if I'm home, I will turn on, through the Sonos system, through Spotify, whatever it is I use, I'll sit down and listen to BBC Radio 5 because I used to live it like I used to participate in Radio 5 and listen to it when I was in London, and it's quite nostalgic. So the point of the story is that I don't have to listen to radio stations in Brisbane. I can listen to radio stations all over the world via my telephone. And it is, it's that sort of technology that radio has to come to grips with. Now, I haven't listened to a local radio station except for when the kids get in the car for yonks, because nothing on Brisbane radio interests me. I will either listen to the sounds of silence or I'll make a phone call, but I will not listen to radio. And I think that's one of the challenges is for radio particularly is to make it interesting. Things that we are doing right now in terms of recording this podcast, that will take over from radio. But again, the technology in cars, most people, I think you'd expect would listen to the radio in their car, whether it be going to or from work, just to see what the traffic's doing. But if you've got digital technology, and you know, you look at the maps these days, the map apps on your phone, they can tell you where, for example, the congestion is, so you can avoid it. So you don't need to sit and listen to the radio just for the. So it's that sort of stuff that that is taking the impact of radio or the usefulness, I suppose, of radio away. I'd hate to see it demise, but if you're and I'm from the era, my old man, you know, when he had holidays, he painted the house and he'd listen to the transistor radio on the trestles. But who would you listen to if you're painting the house these days? What would you listen to?
There's nothing to listen to. It just is quite annoying. Yeah. With my QUT students, we've engaged a couple of radio stations over the years for different projects regarding audiences and diversity and what they want to listen to and just sort of the psyche of people out there in different age groups. And it's been really interesting because they know that the change has been coming for a very long time. And you know, Simon, you the stats you quoted for 14 or to 24-year-old moviegoers reducing, it's the same thing. Now, I ask my students who are predominantly sort of 20-ish, who listens to the radio, who reads newspapers, and it's exactly what you're saying, Pat. They are listening to podcasts. They are listening to what they want to listen to. I mean, even if you can't go to Coachella, you can pick and choose what you want to listen to at the concert or Falls Festival that was on over New Year's Eve here because my daughter was down there. And, you know, they have to go to that band at that particular time. But now with technology, you can listen to whatever you want, whenever you want. Okay, you're right.
Well, this might wrap things up nicely for today's segment, if I could burden you with this story. One thing I've noticed, and it was happening again today when I was purchasing my first batch of hot cross buns. Coles has its own radio station. So it pumps music and, you know, go to aisle six for the bargains. And can I tell you, I wouldn't be surprised, and I will bow to your guys' greater knowledge, but I wouldn't be surprised if they know the age of the people, if they would know the average age of the people that shop at their store and they would cater for their music tastes. So, for example, the two Coles shops closest to me that I go to regularly plays music from my era that I enjoy.
They would
I do not think that that can be an accident.
No, they know exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So back in the day they would have played Triple M or whatever they used to play through the speakers. Now they play specifically, you're listening to Coles radio.
Well, here's my question then, is why do Coles not make that radio station commercially available outside of Coles?
Because the ads that are on it, because that radio station is called Triple M, that plays the sort of songs from my, but the ads that are on it, if you'd like to call them ads, Coles is selling, aren't we great? Coles is selling this at such and such a price.
I thought you were saying there that it was a Coles-specific radio station because there are retailers who have their own radio stations.
Yes, it is. What I'm saying. It's a Coles-specific radio station.
IGA have that as well.
But hold on, you just said it's Triple M.
No. They have a radio station that caters for my era.
Right, gotcha.
A commercial radio station called Triple M.
Right,
Coles doesn't need to do it commercially. Coles, there's no point in Coles doing it commercially because there's already a station free to wear.
What if they? Yeah, but what if they could? What if they? What if they sat there and said, you know, because at the end of the day, they're already producing it because it's already in store.
Sure.
And they don't care about Triple M. They could sit there and go, right, well, on the Coles app, we can now have
but
Coles
But do you
radio.
Know how quickly people would get the shits with listening to at Coles today, you can buy such and such a price. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's only Coles ads. That's all that's on.
Yeah, but I suspect if they did it well, they could probably get around that. I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to be listening to adverts anyway. Sorry, Eddie, go on, you go.
No, you're right. It's Spotify, the same thing. Apple, they all have ads. So, yeah, totally agree, Simon.
You two are ganging up me all the time now.
We're agreeing with you.
Anyway, sorry about that. Anyway, well, welcome back to...
I thought that might wrap things up nicely.
Well, that did. And I was going to say, welcome back to...
I could have done this previously as a profession, but obviously not. I wasn't good enough. They sacked me. But anyway, let's not bang on about that.
Welcome back to 2018, guys. It's
going to be a good year.
It's a pleasure seeing you again. I also just want to make a final point to this episode. This is going to be episode number 13. Now,
lucky to some.
Well, I don't want it to be labelled with that kind of lucky or unlucky, because apparently 13 is the average amount of podcasts that people who produce podcasts do before they give up.
Oh, okay, so we're done.
So,
no.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's been great. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, by the time we do next week's one, number 14, we'll have beaten the average. So that's I just want you to feel good about that. You know?
Yes, because I've maintained an entire professional and personal career about just being average.
Oh, you probably not.
Well, Simon was drinking with a bloke who didn't know who the fudge I was.
Well, once again, thank you very much, guys. It's been a pleasure, and we'll see you both next week. So, welcome to the interview for this week. We have got a gentleman by the name of Mike Boyd, who is the CEO of Vroom Vroom. Vroom. Did I do too many vrooms there? Or was it just what it's vroom, 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 isn't it? Three
That's
vrooms.
It. Three vrooms.
Three vrooms. Who is currently based in Singapore. And what I'm going to get you to do, Mike, is just give us the little 2-minute pitch about what you do and what Vroom, Vroom, Vroom does, just so everybody who doesn't know who you are can get to know you really quickly.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me as well. What do I do? Well, as you said, I'm the CEO of vroom.com.au. We're the largest car rental comparison website in the Southern Hemisphere. So we're a bit like an Expedia or a Webjet or an Agoda, but we specialize in ground transportation. So we work with Hertz and Avis and Budget, Thrifty, Europe Car, all of those major brands. And we compare prices and book vehicles directly through our site all over the world. And we tend to do that better than most people in the Southern Hemisphere, which is where we started a little over 16 years ago. So it's a fantastic little digital company. We've got staff in 12 countries around the world. Wow. 10 of those are represented remotely, and two other countries are staffed offices. So we run a very sort of lean, remote, digital enterprise and service customers all over the globe.
Fantastic. There was a question that I didn't write down that I'm going to launch straight into. It's quite a tough one, especially the industry that you're in, because I normally save this to the end, but I'm going to ask it now, but in case I forget. I read a comment about 3 months ago, 4 months ago, and it was from one of the CEOs of one of those car rental companies that you mentioned. It may well have been Hertz. It was a female CEO. Not that makes any difference, but that's it was one of the CEOs, and they confessed that they perhaps hadn't spent as that the industry hadn't spent as much as it should have done, perhaps in brand and customer care over the past, let's say, 5-10 years. And I'm completely paraphrasing that quote, but that was the basis of the quote. Do you feel that's a fair comment about that industry?
Yeah, look, I think so. I'm not familiar with the quote, but you know, speaking to it generally, I think that it is a fair comment. You know, a lot of these car rental companies are massive US owned enterprises, publicly listed companies, that have tended to follow the US airline model, where they get really, really big, really bureaucratic, and then, you know, try and eke out some level of operational efficiency. But it's pretty hard to do when they're fragmented all over the world and local markets are different. So brands have suffered. Customer care has been outsourced to low-cost, you know, Asian nations or things like that without a huge amount of quality control.
Yeah.
And a lot of the brands have started winding that back now to try and recover. But I think, you know, if we're talking marketing and how a company like Vroom 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 interacts with them, you know, the comment about brand as well is that they've also lost a lot of direct business over the last decade, which you see with any travel company at all. There's a lot more business going to online travel agencies like mine than there is to direct brand. So their proportion of direct sales has decreased. Their proportion of travel agency referred business and online travel agents has increased, and therefore they've lost control of their brand in some circumstances. Yeah. So that's probably what that comment relates to.
And I feel that perhaps that loss of control has turned them into a bit of a commodity, as opposed to, you know, that people having sort of an attraction to one particular brand. And I think that's probably where, and again, I'm jumping straight ahead here, far, far, far ahead of where I would normally go. But I feel that's probably where the success of you guys has stepped in, is that you've had that great brand success with what you've done.
Yeah, that's right. And I actually think it goes far beyond brand. You know, I think what they've really lacked in the last few years, the suppliers themselves, is innovation in general, because it is very much a commoditized industry. You know, there's only so many Toyota Camrys that you can rent, and most of them are white. So, you know, you can slap a Hertz brand on it or an Avis brand or a Europe car. But at the end of the day, their product differentiation really comes down to service. And the service at the counter, you know, when you're arriving to collect your vehicle, or if you're a loyalty member, all those sorts of things haven't really had enough attention in those years. You know, that's where they've literally just focused on fleet size, turnover, utilization rates per day, all those sorts of, you know, industry lingo terms that have nothing to do with human interaction. And that's where they've suffered.
Right. Well, come back to this, because I now want to take you right back to completely the other end of the spectrum and talk about Corley Bar Party Hire.
And that is going back sometime.
It's going back. And the reason I want to take you back there is because that was your first business, wasn't it?
Well, not really the first, but the first one that I acknowledge publicly, I guess.
All right, we won't ask about those other ones, Mike. Yeah. Just in case. Yeah. What on earth made you go into something like that?
Well, you know, it does make for a good story. And you know, I often introduce myself as an entrepreneur first and a CEO second. And so my entrepreneurial journey started at the age of 11, selling lost golf balls, and, you know, started a few different ventures throughout high school. And they were all, you know, tremendous failures. But the stepping stones towards, you know, earning some street smarts, I guess you could say, by making all the mistakes in the book. And Cooley Bar, I guess, was one of those, but ended up having a little bit of success and a whole lot of fun with it. So Cooley Bar originated when I was 17 years old. I was actually just graduating high school, looking to head to uni, and I was one of the older kids in my grade, you know, so I was turning 18 first, and I thought, I want to have the best 18th birthday party possible, because that's going to set the standard for everybody else to follow. And I'm going to go to it, you know, a year's long worth of these fantastic parties, because I'm going to set the bar really high.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my infinite wisdom at 17 years old, I thought that it would be really cool to have a beer keg like in the American, you know, college movies, you know, with the red cups and all that fun, beer keg in the backyard type of thing. And I thought that was a pretty simple idea. You know, rung around a few pubs and bottle shops and all those sorts of things in the local area of Brisbane. And, lo and behold, no one did it anymore. And, you know, even my parents said, oh, no, you know, we used to rent kegs when we were kids and you just call the pub and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, long story short, the pubs themselves were happy to sell a keg, but they weren't into the equipment to dispense it.
Gotcha.
Because it was just, you know, it was too small of a business for them. They didn't want to get called at midnight saying, oh, the pump's not working or the beer's frothy. It was just not core to their business. So basically no one was doing it anymore. And, you know, I called around, you know, and note that I am saying call, right? This is back in the day of literally, you know, yellow pages and a little bit of Google.
Yeah.
And eventually found a guy on the Gold Coast that rented dispensing equipment, but he wanted, on top of the rental fee, he wanted $100 delivery to bring it to Brisbane and then another $100 to pick it up the next day to take it back to the coast. And, that was $200 that I thought I could put towards the beers itself rather than the equipment.
That's so a lot of beer.
It is. And so, you know, my 18th party came and went and we had a whole lot of fun, but I never had a keg. And that was a bit disappointing. And so I just couldn't get it out of my mind. And not long after that, I graduated, you know, had a few months off before starting uni, and thought, I just can't get this out of my head. If I have demand for this, some, you know, other people have to have demand. And, you know, we just learned how to build our own website in grade 12 and all this sort of thing. And I started tinkering with a brand and trying to build, you know, this Keg Hire Brisbane branded site. And eventually it was called Coolie Bar. I ended up going backpacking, went to Asia, landed in Vietnam with a mate, and within 24 hours of landing, we went to an internet cafe back then, of course, no 3G.
Yeah, yeah.
And, and I had all of these random emails into a Gmail account that were inquiries about hiring a keg in Brisbane. And it was the most bizarre thing. I just couldn't understand what was going on. I just landed in Asia. I didn't have a business. All I'd done was muck around with this little HTML template. Yeah. And, what I soon discovered was that there was in fact demand that was shared in the market. It was more than just me looking for the service. And my little half-built website now ranked number one in Google for Keg Hire Brisbane.
Wow.
Because there was literally no other content competing
back,
for
back
it.
In the days when you could do just put a website and then it ranked in Google like the next day, and that was
exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
And for me, good times they were.
You know, it was probably 3 weeks or something, not quite a day, but because it came completely out of the blue. You know, I'd never even finished the website, and so you know that sort of kicked off my holiday and got the brain going while I was backpacking. And I came back, you know, a month later, and you know, scraped together the savings and begged Dad to borrow some money and all this sort of thing, and turned me down a few times, and then ultimately said, as long as you stay in uni and keep your part-time job to pay me back when this fails, then, you know, I'll loan you a couple of grand. And I promised all those things and imported some gear from the US. Long story short, we launched this little business, started renting out, you know, the gas cylinders and the dispensing equipment to chill the beer, partnered with a couple of local pubs to sell the kegs themselves. And we were profitable in under 3 months and went on to run this Coolie Bar party hire business for the next 3 years while I was at uni, and diversified into daiquiri machines and all these other fun stuff. But basically worked a day and a half a week delivering gear on a Friday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon and picking it up on a Sunday afternoon, and you know, cash on delivery. I was a cashed up uni student in the beer business, so it made me pretty popular. And, you know, it was a great time to learn about business. So I like telling that story.
What key things did you learn from that? If there was one lesson that you took from that whole sort of 3 year experience, what was probably the one thing that sticks with you today?
Well, it was really the start of my digital marketing journey. You know, it was almost accidental. You know, I was already IT inclined, but hadn't really started to play on the marketing side. And while we had this early success with SEO and ranking, we ultimately scaled the business using the very early days of social media. We actually offered to send photographers, which were just mates of mine, to the parties that we were dropping kegs off to.
Right.
To photograph their party for free.
Yeah.
And we would upload them on Facebook with our watermark, you know, and our logo on the bottom right hand. Yeah. And so, you know, this was our target market was 18th and 21st. Yeah. And that was basically all that was on social media in those days. So it was kind of, you know, first mover advantage. And the hosts were usually very welcome, you know, very willing to have us provide the photos.
That's sort of almost early days. You're always forcing yourself to go viral there, aren't you? Because
that's right.
You know, by sharing 200 photos of someone's party and everybody's, I mean, I don't know, you couldn't even tag each other back then, but you certainly people were sharing them on and things like that. But I can imagine the reach that you gained from that was incredible.
Oh, it was massive. You know, it was early days, social and content marketing, and we didn't even really know what it was, but we knew it worked. So we just kept doing it. And, you know, so it taught us a lot about business, but gosh, we made, you know, every mistake as well, because, you know, I didn't know how to do any bookkeeping and I didn't know how to, you know, even run the operational side of the business. Where do you store equipment and clean it and turn it around? And now we need delivery utes and employees and all those sorts of things were, you know, really that was what I reflect on as the great foundation to my business education. I was at uni doing a business degree. Yeah. But, you know, I'd sneak out of lectures because my phone was ringing or I got an email on my laptop someone ordering a keg, you know. And so I'd sit up the back booking a keg in for Saturday afternoon while pretending to do a business degree. So, you know, it was a pretty cool time.
I can imagine how popular you were with the other students. God, that sounds great. So, I mean, I guess, as you say, you took a lot out of that, but... I guess obviously the main thing you took out of that was the digital marketing. Was that something you sat there and went back then? You kind of went, this is the next thing, that social media space, the Google space, because back then, I mean, we're talking 2009, aren't we? So I'm just thinking where Facebook was in 2009 and things like that. It was still very early days, wasn't it?
Very early. Yeah. And it was even a couple of years preceding that before it really scaled beyond a hobby. So yeah, you're talking like 07, 08, 09 when we were, you know, really started playing with it. So look, it did open my eyes and got me really excited about it. But I also didn't really realize the extent of what I was sitting on. It just worked and it was almost too easy. And, but you know, it slowly dawned on me because at the same time, I started a not-for-profit organization called The Hive, or The Hive Network in Brisbane. And I did that while I was at uni as well. I ran it for 3 years in Brisbane, and it was basically an event once a month for free, held in a bar somewhere in town there. And we'd invite a prominent entrepreneur from the community to come along and tell their story. Yeah. So it was basically... you know, those that had already made it coming along and just sharing some wisdom with those that were keen and eager. And the most fascinating thing that came out of that was that, you know, I was the host of the event and I'd introduce these speakers and I'd spend a lot of time in between events chasing the next speaker and emailing them and inviting them to come and volunteer their time. And they'd turn up to speak and introduce themselves to me and ultimately ask me what I did. And I'd say, oh, well, you know, I'm a uni student, but I got this business called Cooley Bar and this is what we do. And, you know,
anyone want a frozen daiquiri? Yeah,
exactly. Here's your mojito and, you know, can I offer you a beer sort of thing? And, but, you know, we got talking and they said, well, tell me about this Cooley Bar. And I said, well, you know, we have photographers and we do this Facebook thing and we rank in Google and da, da, da. And I realized very quickly that these very successful entrepreneurs and CEOs that I was talking to, that were sometimes running, you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar businesses, had no idea what I was talking about.
Yeah.
It was just lingo that they kind of had heard of, had no idea really the detail, and they were fascinated. And that actually led me into my next opportunity. So you said, you know, what did I get out of Cooley Bar? I say an insight into digital marketing because I then, you know, quickly transformed myself into a – digital marketing consultants, and my clients were Hive speakers. And, you know, they literally said, "Can you come in and tell that story to my marketing manager? So can you come into my board?"
Yeah, you almost went and created your own funnel of clients there with the Hive.
Exactly, and again by accident.
Yeah.
So I literally, I was flown into state. I presented to boardrooms. I presented to marketing teams. You know, and I was just, you know, what was I at the time, 19-year-old kid going in there. And, you know, the first time someone said, "Oh, what do you charge for this?" And I went, "Oh, gosh, I don't know." you know, like all I'd done at that stage is build my own business and work hospitality. So I thought I'd charge more than that. And I just said, $50 an hour. And the first person said, "That's too little. I'll pay you $100. And I said, "Oh, okay." And so, you know, I went in and did 3 hours for them or something. And then the next one came along and they said, "What do you charge for this?" And I said, $200 an hour. And they went, "Okay, can you come in on Monday?" I said, "Sure." The next one came along, and, you know, it went on and on. So I ended up charging about $350 an hour for these consulting. And back then it wasn't even called digital. It was called social media marketing. But it was amazing. You know, I got some early results for some really big brands and opened my eyes to, you know, an even bigger business community.
Yeah.
And I figured out at the same time that as an entrepreneur, I didn't want to be a consultant my whole life. You know, a fantastic way to make money, but it was all hours for dollars.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't want to trade my hours for dollars. I loved building a business where I could employ people or build a system or something that ultimately bought me freedom rather than, you know, more work.
The Hive, I think the Hive is where I first met you. And it might have been the Hive or it might have been that you were speaking at another... It was back then when entrepreneurship wasn't really a word. I mean, people obviously knew what the word was, but they didn't. It didn't quite have the same ring that it has to it now.
Yep,
it's definitely. It's not the same sort of. You know, people I think looked at you a bit weird back then if you classed yourself as an entrepreneur.
You know, I started the Hive after going to this entrepreneurship camp. It was called a creative entrepreneurship camp for young people. It was the most bizarre sounding thing. I had to check that it wasn't a hippie commune first, you know, because you're right, back then it was, you know, it was not a thing. It was not an existing community. But sure enough, it was run by a reputable group and I met some amazing people that were all sort of, you know, teens or early 20s. And we went up to the Glasshouse Mountains there and I don't know, 3 or 4 days or something. We did this process of creatively mapping out, you know, businesses and entrepreneurship, a lot of not-for-profit type work and everything as well. And I'll never forget, one of the things they taught me there was that, you know, their whole philosophy was validating weirdos.
Right. Okay.
And I just went, now I know where I fit, you know. Or I remember calling my mother, who also never understood me. I remember calling my mother from this camp and I said, "I have found where I fit in the world." There's a bunch of other weirdos here.
Congratulations, you know, mother. I'm a weirdo. Yes.
Exactly. I now have a label that sticks, you know. And but no, it was weird back then to say you wanted to be an entrepreneur, you know. Yeah. Like I was going to a prestigious university, studying a prestigious degree, doing all of the right things, and I hated it. I absolutely hated it. All I wanted to do was get out and try stuff and create stuff and build stuff. And so I actually came away from that camp with a promise that I was going to start the Hive. And I literally started a month later. That was sort of the inspiration. But I didn't found the concept. Some friends of mine that I connected with in the very early days of Twitter, I think it was 2007, 2008, they were based in Melbourne. They were RMIT students. And they actually started the Hive as an RMIT project.
Right.
And it was a little not-for-profit. And, you know, same story, prominent entrepreneurs from Melbourne telling their story in a bar for free. And it was quite successful. So they ran it. They ran, you know, 10 or 11 events in their first year. I'd seen it from afar on Twitter, thought, this is amazing. I wish we had that in Brisbane. So after I'd been to this camp, I flew to Melbourne, took the guys out for a beer and, begged and pleaded to let me expand the concept to Brisbane. And they were pretty reluctant because they'd had some success and they didn't want anyone to tarnish their brand and all of those sorts of things. And I said, look, just give me a shot. give me one event. You guys come up for it, you know, give me 60 days. I'll put on an event. If it's not successful, pull the pin.
Yeah.
And they agreed. And you know, it's sort of a classic entrepreneur story. 3 days before the event, the speaker pulled out. And then, you know, 48 hours before, the venue cancelled because we didn't have enough pre-booked numbers to cover the minimum spend and all this sort of shit, you know. Yeah. And again, I was 18, 19, promising everyone the world, and then realized we didn't have a microphone and all this sort of stuff. And in the end, through friends and a good amount of hustle and a very good amount of luck, managed to pull off this event. We got about 60 people there, and it was, you know, a resounding success. And, you know, the most interesting part of all of that, looking back, is that the first ever speaker, the backup speaker after the first one pulled out 3 days prior, the backup speaker that we got in as an emergency was one of the very early employees of a company called Vroom Vroom Vroom, which I now happen to own and run.
Right. Very fortuitous.
Funny how those things. Yeah. It's funny how those things come together, right? So, you know, absolutely. We went on to run the Hive for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, monthly events. It was a tremendous success.
Obviously what came out of that, and I think this was the other thing that I met when I met you, this is what one of the things that you were doing was Cupstart. And when I look at what you were doing with Cupstart, I kind of think it feels like it was a little bit before its time. Do you feel the same sort of thing as well?
Yeah, it was definitely early and also a little naive. So, you know, Cupstart was a, you know, an attempt by me to merge two passions, which was coffee. I love espresso based coffee and finding great coffee shops and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, which also wasn't as big a decade ago. You know, there's always been an underground coffee community, but nowhere near as popular as it is in Australia today. And technology. So I wanted to mash those two things together and build a company around that, because I thought everyone says follow your passion. So I thought I'll build a coffee app.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was an online ordering system or a mobile ordering system, so you could order your coffee in advance. You know, order it 10 minutes ahead and drop by the cafe and collect it. So great for the community cafe. If you're ordering it on the way to work, you pull over and pick up your coffee and keep going, or, you know, and you didn't have to have cash on you because it was all prepaid credits and all digital and everything. So it was also an attempt by me to build a company that was actually a product, not a service. It was an attempt to get away from that consulting world.
Yes.
And, so, look, long story short, I scraped together some savings, funded it all myself, literally got onto, I think it was eBay. I was going to say Alibaba, but it wasn't. It was eBay back then, and bought these really cheap Intel laptops out of Hong Kong, which I'd give to the cafes to receive orders on them. They were like Windows XP or 98 or something horrendous. And I've got a photo of me sitting on the floor in my living room with about 8 of these laptops all lit up around me as I'm, you know, loading each of them, with, you know, setting up. And you know, so look, Cupstart was successful in terms of proof of concept. We had 4 or 5 cafes in Brisbane running it every day and receiving orders for coffees through it every day. And we had loyal customers. You know, so the most successful one was in the CBD, where it was a cafe actually based in the foyer of a building, and people would order from their office on the 14th floor and come down the lift. And by the time they came down, it was ready to collect, and they'd take a tray of coffees back up to the meeting sort of thing. They didn't have to line up and they didn't have to worry about cash and all of that. So, you know, it was successful in terms of product market fit, but where it failed was the business model and the commercial side of it. It was something where we were making about 20 cents per cup.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think at the height, we, you know, our record was like 30 cups in one day. So you got to do a lot of cups at 20 cents to make money, you know, and particularly when we were buying these these laptops that cost a couple of hundred dollars each and giving them to the cafes just to receive the orders, and then marketing on top of that to get users and all of that. So persisted with it for about 12 months, and it was showing promising signs, had that early validation, but then didn't really know what to do next.
Yeah.
And I got connected to a guy who I sat down with for a coffee, ironically, and his name was Steve Baxter. And Steve, you know, everyone knows that name now, but
nobody did back then. Nobody did back then. Yeah, absolutely.
And so someone had referred Steve to me because I was running this great Hive community, and it was the biggest entrepreneurial community in Queensland, and collectively between Melbourne and the Sydney chapter that launched and everything, we were the biggest in the country. Not-for-profit entrepreneurial community. And Steve was starting to think about the idea of starting this thing called River City Labs, and which he's since gone on to do, and it's fantastic. But he said, you know, is there a way we can bring the Hive community in, you know, to River City Labs? Can we collaborate, all that sort of thing? And I'd actually just reached the end, or just about to reach the end of my time with the Hive. I ran it for 3 years. I was pretty exhausted by the end of it. Needed the next challenge to sink my teeth into. And I said, mate, by all means, if you can pick up this baton and run with it and, you know, and genuinely do good for the community and not just flog stuff to them, that'd be fantastic. And so that's what our conversation was about. And then I said, you know, what else are you up to? And he said, oh, well, you know, I've made my money in these, you know, things, and now I'm investing. And he said, actually, I've just invested in this great startup. It's called Text for Coffee. And it's a mobile coffee ordering app, and it does this and this and this. And I just went, oh, you've got to be kidding me. You know, it was my only decent competitor at the time. And Steve, you know, with unlimited financial resources and about to make a serious move in the Queensland startup space, had just invested in my only competitor. I just went, ah. So, you know, I came away from that meeting and used all the swear words under the sun. And
I can imagine.
And, you know, just went, gosh, 12 months of my life and all that sort of thing. And in the end, I actually think my product is a bit better than theirs, but, you know, that means nothing unless you get the customer and the dollars. So I decided to leave it there and, you know, sort of wound it up probably, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later. And there was a bunch of disappointed customers because they loved using it, but it just wasn't a sustainable model. And so I took that learning and, you know, went in search of an industry that could afford to pay more than 20 cents a cup, in whatever that was.
Before you step into that one, I just want to get an understanding. When you were looking, when you had Cupstart and you went to look for these cafes, how did you do that? Was it just, you know, you on foot knocking on doors?
Yeah, it was quite literally this young kid walking into the cafe saying, hey, I really like coffee and I built this coffee app and would you be willing to try this? And I'll give you a laptop and I'll put a little A4 sign on your counter and customers can order ahead. And it was pretty hard, but, you know, again, it was cutting my teeth on sales. It was literally door-to-door sales and being rejected countless times and, you know, ultimately getting a sit-down with the owner. Because you'd walk in, obviously, and there'd just be another teenage barista behind the counter who can't make a decision like that. Yeah. You know, so even just getting access to the decision-maker and then coming back and then ultimately getting them interested. And these are the things you learn as well. These are all small business people.
Yeah.
They're running small cafes typically because I didn't go after like a Gloria Jeans or anything. I was going after independent cafes that did great coffee and you know, a lot of them were even resistant to 20 cents a cup because their margins were skinny as it was. Yeah, so originally there was ideas around having a subscription model of a couple of $100 a month plus, you know, a fee per cup and all this sort of thing. And at the end of the day, there just wasn't appetite in the market. They weren't prepared to pay.
How many, I know this is sort of asking you to think back a bit, but how many doors would have you knocked on to get your, I think you said 5 or 6 clients?
Yeah, I think it was 4 or 5 operational in the end.
Okay.
And so,
what do you reckon you knocked on the doors?
I'd say probably 30.
Okay. That's not
a terrible conversion rate, you know, and I've done it for the one.
Sorry, I was just saying we did a masterclass with a friend of mine about conversion rates. And, you know, I would say to anyone starting a business, if you're going to see 30 clients and get four, if you're going to see 30 people and get four clients out of it, that's a pretty good success rate, really.
Yeah, yeah. And look, the advantage I had was that there was no cost up front.
Yeah.
It was just, are you willing to stick this on your counter? And yeah. And then the problem I had was that they wouldn't train their staff. So an order would go through and no one would see it.
Yeah.
So someone would turn up at a cafe that pre-ordered and they'd stand around waiting and then eventually ask, where's my coffee? And, you know, so there was all those sorts of teething issues. Yeah. But I also used some of that early technology success to pursue coffee shops that I could see had even a little bit of digital presence. Yeah. And I thought they'd be more open to this tech play. So any cafes that I could connect to on Twitter or Facebook or their founders or owners, that sort of thing, they're the ones I went after, which probably improved my success as well.
I think one of the things that I take out of that and that I obviously say to a lot of businesses is that certainly in the early days, or certainly if you want to grow your business, there's an element where you have to be a salesperson. You have to not necessarily knock 100%. On doors, but you've got to you've got to be able to sell yourself. And if you want that fast growth, for you going out and seeing 30 cafes, I mean, if you think about exact numbers, you could probably get around to 10 or 12 cafes in a day.
Yep.
So realistically, maybe let's say that's 60 cafes a week. If looking back on it now, you go, right, well, that's 60 cafes a week. And in a month, that's 240 and I'm converting 20% of them. That makes sense as a business model. But for a lot of businesses, business owners, the concept of saying to them, you need to get off your ass and knock on some doors, or you need to pick up the phone and call some people, or you just need to just get in front of people, they find that quite hard to do.
Oh, exactly. And then add on top of that, the insecurity, the stress, the anxiety of having created the product. Yeah. And then hear people tell you why it sucks, you know, and then turn up for the next sales meeting. You know, I would have loved to have done 60 a week, but often it would take, you know, all my courage to get to 3 or 4 in a week because I'd have to recover between them because someone would say, oh, but I want to have this feature, or I'm not paying 20 cents. I'll pay 8 cents or what about this? Or I will only list my copies on your platform, you know, and increase the price on your platform to cover your fee. And I said, but these are your regular customers. These are people that are coming to your cafe every day. We're trying to save them, you know, 5-10 minutes and make it more convenient, make it more sticky, blah, blah, blah. And they said, yeah, that's fine, but I'm going to charge an extra 20 cents on the coffee. And I said, well, that's not going to work, is it? So you're just constantly handling, you know, rejections or curveballs and things like that. And again, you know, all of these stories, you've really dug into my history. It's fantastic, this conversation. You know, it all makes sense now.
Yeah.
You know, and learning those early sales skills. And, you know, these days I'm not selling coffee, but I'm either selling myself or the services of my company. And
I would say to you now that if somebody put Mike Boyd on the spot and said, you've now got to go and see 10 clients and sell vroom, vroom, vroom to them, I'd bet probably, you know, a week's wages that you'd crack 9 out of 10 of them.
Oh, yeah, look, absolutely. And that's not, you know, blowing steam up the steam.
No.
That's actually a tremendous skill that we've developed over time. And it's because of that early grind and all of that early rejection and not actually giving up. You know, you can get rejected 100 times, but if you go 101 times and you get a sale, it makes up for all of it. And that's why it's worth persisting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to sort of jump forward because sadly, I mean, I'm sure you and I could probably talk for a couple of hours here, but I want to jump forward to vroom, vroom, vroom now. So, just quickly, just so I can understand, or everyone else out there can understand, how you got involved in the business. Cause I believe you were consulting to them first and then ended up sort of transitioning into there.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's interesting, all these stories trying to tie it together. You know, I was at uni, I ran Coolie Bar for a couple of years. I started The Hive not long after. Richard from Vroom was the first Hive speaker, you know, for the first event, and the event series then went on for 3 years. So, you know, nothing actually came of that initial discussion. It was years later that Vroom hit a bit of a rough patch, and the CEO was living in London, a very long way away from where the bulk of the business was.
Yeah.
And he was the CEO because he was the major shareholder, and the company was being run by two very talented technologists, brothers in Brisbane, Richard and Dave, and Richard was the one that spoke for us at the Hive. So it's a bit of a complicated story, but basically what happened was, you know, the guys were brilliant at building and scaling the technology side of the business and the SEO and the inbound marketing in particular, particularly in the age in which they built it in the early 2000s. But when it got into a larger business, they weren't as skilled at actually building a business and growing a business and managing staff and operations and all those other things.
Which frequently happens with tech-focused people, doesn't it?
Completely, right? And so the majority of the leadership was tech-focused. The company experienced growing pains because it had doubled and tripled every year as a startup. You know, it had all of those great success stories, but then all of a sudden it sort of got a bit big, a bit bloated. And there was contracts and legals and all these other things. And so they needed a bit of a commercial head to come in and get them back on the straight and narrow. And they thought that they just needed a little bit of advice for a couple of hours. So, you know, Richard thought of me because we'd connected through the Hive. And after being the first speaker, he was, you know, being the humble dude that he is, he would often just show up every month and listen to every other speaker as well. He wasn't too good for that. You know, I always admire him for that. And so we stayed connected, became friends, and he reached out to me and said, you know, Mike, can you come in and give us a couple of hours of your time and see if you can help us with some of these commercials? So long story short, came in, had a bit of a look at what they needed some help with and realized they needed a hell of a lot more than a couple of hours. And, you know, ultimately, I was trying to get away from consulting, but wanted to help them out. It was a great business and great people. They were just in a bit of a bind. And I was trying to build another startup on the side, but I carved it out because, you know, when you're building startups, you're not really making money. So I welcomed the money and said, look, I'll do a day a week for you.
Yeah.
And so I did that, ultimately took on the title of COO, because I had to liaise with a lot of external suppliers and car rental companies and all these sorts of things. And I wanted to know who this guy was that was sort of, you know, improving all these systems and operations. And so I did that as a consultant for a while and put some really early runs on the board. So renegotiated contracts, got commission increases across the board, saved a bunch of money in unnecessary expenses, HR, simple, you know, what I view as simple stuff now, but it wasn't simple back then. And so the CEO, who was, like I said, based in London, saw all this from afar. We'd never even met. We'd just spoken on Skype all the time. And he said, look, Mike, love what you're doing, but it's not enough. You know, can I encourage you to come on board full time?
Right.
And I said, Pete, thank you. You know, you really appreciate it, generous offer, but, you know, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I'm not looking for a high-paying gig or a fancy title. You know, I could accept the role, but, you know, I'd probably last 2 or 3 months before I hated myself because I wasn't being true to what I want to do. So, you know, it's not going to be successful for either of us. And he said, oh, you know, all right, thanks anyway, sort of thing. And that went on for 12 months. He ended up offering me the role. You know, initially it was full-time. Then it was, will you take on the CEO role for me? I turned him down 3 times. The fourth time, you know, the first three conversations were basically the same. And the fourth conversation was quite serendipitous. I was working on this other startup in cloud-based software, again, investing sort of 12 months there. And it went pear-shaped in a big, big way. It, you know, the people that were putting the money in ran out of money and it collapsed with debts. And I was this young guy that was all in for sweat equity. So I hadn't really put money in, but I was on the line for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I think, in the end, of my share of the debt, because we were, you know, one-third shareholders type of thing. And so I was in a lot of trouble, all of a sudden. And quite literally the same week that we had to liquidate that company and let go of the early employees, literally the most difficult time of my life. It was the biggest failure, biggest fuck up. 4 days later, Pete called me from London and said, Mike, I've figured it out. I want you to come on board with Room full time. I know you don't want to be an employee. That's not what motivates you. You're an entrepreneur. You like to build your own businesses. So I want you to be my business partner, take a small equity stake in the company, and come on full time and run it like your own. And I went, oh, Pete, I think you finally twisted my arm.
Yeah. You're down the other end of the phone, still trying to play it really cool, I think, at that point, aren't you?
I was so trying, but, you know, like, it was literally the worst time of my life. And then, you know, he calls out of the blue with that, and I just went, yes, that sounds great. Let's figure that out, you know? And so that started that chapter.
I want to ask that question about that, the debt issue, because it's something I face myself when you sit there and you go, something's failed or something hasn't succeeded how it's supposed to succeed, and you suddenly realize that you owe a lot of money. How do you mentally deal with that? Was that, I mean, a lot of people, it keeps a lot of people awake a lot, you know, they lose sleep and they, you know, relationships fail because of it. How do you mentally deal with something like that?
Mate, that's a terrific question. And I don't think I could do it justice, because, you know, that is that 7 or 8 years ago for me now, and I think I'm still dealing with it. I don't think I've, you know, fully recovered or processed from it. It still haunts me to a degree. And again, it has shaped me as a business person.
Yeah.
But probably what I've learned the most from there is forget about the personal situation it put me in. The thing that I just play over and over and over in my mind is sitting down in front of our 3 full-time developers, right? Because we're trying to build cloud-based apps for the mining and software, mining and engineering space, yeah, at the height of the mining boom too. So we thought, you know, here's clients that can pay. This is a no-brainer. Yeah. Sitting down in front of these 3 full-time devs, which were basically the early employees, with tears streaming down my face, letting them know that the company was, we just discovered the company was trading insolvent. We had no choice but to wind it up. And I'm sorry, but there's no jobs for you as of right now.
Yeah.
And it was just heartbreaking, obviously for them, but heartbreaking for me, and just the most awful thing to do. And, you know, because I was there working for Sweat Equity, I'd been there alongside them in the trenches every day building these incredible products. Yeah. And we had built incredible products. And so it was also really sad to let the products go and not see them, you know, through to their full potential in the market. So, going back to your question about the debt and the, you know, the personal circumstances, I still say that the best deal I've ever done in my life was figuring out how to get out of that mess.
Yeah.
And, a whole bunch of it's probably still confidential, but long story short, I was in the business of 2 other guys that were funding it, and they let it drop in terms of you couldn't uphold their obligations. They ran out of money. And, but everyone was still super passionate about what we'd built. I think it was one of their cousins or one of their uncles or something had always wanted to be in the business and had some money. And, I ended up orchestrating a deal to sell all of my equity to this cousin or uncle in exchange for clearing the entire debts of the company.
Right.
So I basically fell on my sword and said, don't let this go into insolvency. Don't let it have creditors. I don't want a black mark on my name. I was like 20 years old, 21. I said, I'm going to build too many businesses in my life to have this sort of a failure this early.
Yeah.
So I was all about legacy and preservation of reputation and all of that. Yeah. So I basically fell on my sword and did that, and allowed them to settle a debt and rebirth the company at a later date to pursue those same products, which they did. And it was pretty heartbreaking again then not to be a part of that second act, but I was fortunate just to get away from the mess, to be honest, and that's very, very much the right decision.
On a more positive note, as we sort of move to the end of this, because as I say, there's probably at least another 20 questions I could ask you now. What I want to touch on is what, from a digital marketing perspective, I really want to just talk about that for the last section, and understand from you what your tips would be to a business owner or a startup or somebody that's even well established around digital marketing, based with all the knowledge that you've had from your early days of Cupstart and Party Hire, and now with the entity that is Vroom Vroom Vroom. What do you think people should be doing or focusing on from a digital marketing perspective?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. I think if I was to talk at a high level across all industries and all stages of business, the high level stuff that I would talk about in terms of digital marketing, and certainly that's worked for me across multiple ventures, is never underestimate unique content. Never underestimate unique content that you create. You know, in Vroom Vroom Vroom, we have been tremendously successful with SEO and organic rank. And it's because over a decade, we developed well in excess of 10,000 content pages with real unique content for all of the major locations that we rent cars across the globe.
Give me an example just of what you define, because I would know what you would define as content. Just for people listening, what's your definition of creating content, a content page?
This specific example is very, you know, considered old school in the industry, really. I mean, we have location pages for Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, or Brisbane Airport. More specifically, diving into the regions, Wollongong, Geelong, downtown Boston, Los Angeles, Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. And that's because, you know, we were playing the SEO game, matching long tail searches, ranking number 1, 2, and 3 in Google often for 3 different web properties that we owned, just because we had the most relevant content. Now, what went on that content page? Well, not only did we have the URL string that was you know, highly relevant to that, it was, you know, vroom.com/US/Massachusetts/Boston/downtown things to see and do type of thing. Right. And but what we would do is, around those locations, there's only so much you can say about renting a car. So we really built it into travel guides, you know, places to go, things to see, top restaurants, top cafes, you know, where do you refuel the car, all those sorts of things. So tips and tricks, but very much location-specific content worked very, very well for us in the Vroom business. You know, if I go back to Cooley Bar, the unique content was photographing the parties.
Yeah.
Highly personalized content that was, and people would share it with their friends. The other thing I'd say too is that, you know, from a digital marketing perspective, transactional-based marketing, so things like PPC, you know, paying for Google ads, paying for Facebook ads, paying for Twitter ads, Snapchat, whatever it is that's in vogue at the time, it will always be a limited opportunity. You know, something is priced cheap in the beginning, then it's priced very, very expensive in the end, and then the attention shifts to another platform.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you can build a brand on. It's not something that you can build, you know, long-term sticky customers on. If you have an over-reliance on transaction-based marketing rather than it just being supplementary to what you do, you know, it's something that could be a very, very big risk. So in the last few years, we've eliminated a lot of competitors competing with our car rental business that relied purely on Google AdWords.
Yeah.
And they've now been completely priced out of the market. As you can imagine, car rental search terms are extremely expensive to bid on.
Scare me as to what a car rental search term click is worth.
Oh, in the tens of dollars.
Right.
So, okay. You know, easily $10, $15, $25.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the commissions aren't outrageous in the industry. So, you know, you're lost leading in that territory, you're lost leading. Because of course that's just a click, not a conversion. And you know, there's a whole bunch of other factors. So the people that are running those strategies really are running it as lost leading, hoping to get 3 or 4 rentals from someone in order to break even. Whereas You know, we have a lot more direct brand, a lot more organic, a lot more social and video, and would much prefer to go after a profitable sale rather than loss leading.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, depending on which channel, which industry you look at, Google AdWords really only accounts for, normally I say to people, 15% of the traffic clicks, and the organic rankings normally, account for 60%, and then there's a loss of people who just don't click on anything. But
yeah,
so if you're just relying on AdWords, you're only ever going to get 15% of the of the traffic at the most.
That's right. And you know, Google has dominated as a monopoly for so long, but that's not to say that the entire platform or the entire way of searching and discovering content is changing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more mobile. There's a lot more just stuck entirely in the Facebook ecosystem. There's a really fast acceleration towards voice search at the moment with...
Well, I was just going to actually jump in there and say to you, how is voice going to affect... How do you think voice is going to affect your industry within, the next 5 years? What are you guys doing around that?
Yeah, well, look, we're starting to play with it. We've, I bought Google Home and Alexas and stuff for the dev team to literally play with and become familiar with, so that we can eventually start playing with our own apps and services for it. And really just at that innovation level, pulling stuff apart and seeing what's possible.
Yeah.
But where do I think it's going in 5 years? Well, you know, much like Amazon has their, I forgot the name of them, the buttons to reorder commodity products, you know, like washing detergent. You push the button and it just arrives the next day or the same day, and it's a single button for a single product. I see car rental as a highly, highly commoditized industry where there's not much product differentiation. And so whoever wins voice wins the market, because you'll just ask Siri or you'll just ask Google, or you'll just ask Alexa, hey, can you book me a car? It's either going to be an autonomous car, which is a whole nother conversation, can you book me a car for tomorrow in Sydney? Look up when my flight lands and I'll get it then, sort of thing. You know, and the AI will be able to match the flight number really easily, see when it's due to land in Sydney Airport, book you a car at 4 p.m. And it won't ask you, do you want to search Vroom or do you want to search Hertz or do you want to search Avis? It'll just be whoever's got the best voice bot for car rental that determines that language query will surface the result and get the booking.
Autonomous cars is another hour-long conversation.
At least we
can't have today, but maybe we'll postpone that one for another time. But last three questions before I let you go. The first one is, what are some of the other brands out there that you love, that you look at every day and go, you know, we should be more like them, or brands that you buy yourself all the time that you get attracted to?
Yeah, great question. I try and, think of things that are a little bit different. And I, just thinking about the experience I had this week, I moved to Singapore this year and it's hot and humid here all the time, obviously, right? So I went out to the yoga clothing brand Lululemon and I was shopping for some shorts. And I thought, nice and comfy, breathable, great for the climate, all that sort of thing. And I'm looking at the tag on these shorts, because there's a different range of them and they're all talking about their vortex this or their great material that, or their and I'm just like, I just want shorts, shorts that kind of look dressy, but, because I'm not going to the gym, but I just want something that's comfy. And I turn over the tag, and one of the first things that this Lululemon shorts professes to have is ABC. And directly after the acronym is its explanation that says anti-ball crushers. And I just thought, it's trademarked. Trademarked anti-ball crushers, and that's the way they describe their men's shorts range at Lululemon. I just thought, fuck, I'm going to buy them just because that's brilliant marketing.
Because they put that on the label, yeah.
Just thought, what a way to stand out and really connect.
For years, Mike, I've wondered which men's shop at Lululemon, as my wife calls it, or Lululemon.
There you go.
I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm not an expert. And because I'm always like a $7, $5 Kmart pair of shorts, because I'm like, it's just... I'm just going running in these things. It doesn't matter what I look like. But now, now I've met a man who shops there, and I like it's
and a real man, like
yeah,
that.
A real man.
I mean, come on,
and
you,
and, but you've also given me a good reason as to why you shop there, so I'll accept that. That's fine. Look, are there any others out there? What about in your industry? What are some of the other travel brands that you look at? You think do a really good job out there?
You know, look, I travel a lot. That's part of the reason I live in Asia, because I travel up to the Northern Hemisphere, you know, a lot, and sort of like a halfway home for me. I like to be one flight to anywhere in the world, and Singapore's a great spot for that. And so I'm often a bigger customer of airlines than I am car rental myself. You know, when I'm in travel and I look at, you know, I used to fly a lot of Qantas because I used to be based in Hong Kong and Manila, and I used to fly a lot of Qantas, a lot of Cathay. In the last few years, I've flown Emirates, a lot of Singapore Air, and it's amazing to compare another commodity product like airlines, similar to car rental, and when you're getting to the not only the pointy end of the plane, but also the highest status frequent flyer and all this sort of the friction points that only frequent travelers notice and overcome has been, you know, fascinating for me to see and understand. And I think that, you know, certainly in the international markets, an airline like Qantas is easily being outcompeted.
Yeah.
And that'd be, you know, very easy to claim because a lot of the other airlines are better funded. But it just comes down to pure service and product fit. So I'm trying to think of a great example for you, but
well, I guess, you know, my question would be, if you had a choice of flying, which airline would you choose?
I would choose Singapore Airlines.
Okay.
These days. Yeah. Yeah. I recently had an amazing experience on Emirates because I used a bunch of frequent flyer points to fly to Canada first class. And that was amazing. And it's all, you know, there's a shower and all that sort of stuff on board. But, you know, it was wow because it's designed to be wow.
Yeah.
And you're in your own little closed off pod. But in terms of day-to-day travel and consistent experience and consistent service, after flying, like to put it in perspective for you, last year I flew over 100 flights, circumnavigated the globe 8 times, and spent 16 physical days in the sky.
Wow.
So I've had a fair bit of time in the cabin to assess planes, airports. And look, honestly, that's the other thing too. It's the off the ground experience. It's check in through airports, through security, through lounges, how you're treated, how that can be streamlined. You know, to answer your question, I actually think brands as a country have been really interesting. So I used to be a Hong Kong resident. Now I'm a Singapore resident.
Yeah.
And they both have smart ID cards.
Okay.
So when I'd fly through Hong Kong airport, which I'd do literally twice a month, I would turn up with my little credit card sized ID card, which had my, you know, photo on it and a chip. And I would put it into this, you know, like a ATM machine at the airport. And it would say, yep, Michael Boyd, thank you. Spit out the card. I'd walk through the first set of gates, scan my thumbprint, the next set of gates would open, and I'd be in the country. And not once did I even lift my passport out of my pocket.
Yeah.
Now, and it was literally, you know, 40 seconds to get through immigration. And, you know, Singapore is very, very similar. So
it's taking that lesson from something like that that I think a lot of businesses need to take that lesson. The less friction that people have when they deal with your business, then the more pleasurable the experience is going to be, and the more often they'll come back, and the more times they'll recommend you and remember you and spend more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing that I noticed too at the frequent flyer end, you know, no one flies that often because they love it. It's not actually glamorous. You know, I quite enjoy flying. I quite enjoy travel, but it is exhausting. It's tiring. It's all of those things. And so anybody that eliminates even the smallest friction point, when you're going through an airport every single week of your life, you notice and you appreciate it. And I will spend money on an airline or even to fly through a connecting city that does it better than going via one that's inferior. You know, and that's where as a brand and as a business or even as a country, it really works.
Yeah.
Because I'll choose to, you know, fly from Australia to London through certain airports rather than others, and pay another $1,000 because it's not worth my time or the friction to do it the wrong way.
Last couple of questions for you before I let you go. What is 2018 going to hold for Vroom Vroom Vroom? What are your big sort of objectives for this year?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, on a simplistic level, the brand will turn 17. So, you know, that's a really
old online brand, isn't it?
Right.
I know.
2001.
Wow. You know,
that's like the age of the modern internet. That's the age of e-commerce. So, an incredibly long stint. Consistently from the brand. And so it's, for us, it's about consolidation. It's probably more getting to the stage of more branding and less sales, you know, less transactional analytics and PPC and all that sort of stuff that I was touching on before, and more just pure, you know, this is who we are, this is what we stand for, and you know where to find us when you need us sort of thing. Because we're at a certain scale too, where we can do that. We're also diversifying left and right. So, you know, we also do a huge amount of camper van and motorhome bookings. We have an insurance business that I founded a couple of years ago that we didn't talk about today, but it's an ancillary upsell to the Vroom product so that you can insure in case you're in an accident, the vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, this year we're getting into airport transfers, you know, limousine transfers, bus transfers, that sort of thing. Because, you know, some cities that you fly into aren't really geared for car rental. So you know, even here in Singapore, it's not the biggest self-drive market. You're more likely to be picked up and chauffeured to your hotel or catch the MRT or something like that. Yeah. Same with London Heathrow. You know, I fly in there all the time, but I catch the Heathrow Express train into town and then get a taxi across town because parking and driving through London, I have no idea what I'm doing. But if I'm going, you know, further out in the UK, then I'd rent a car. So trying to get that full ground transportation product mix is on the agenda for us. And we've also launched a new business and a new brand last year called V2B Travel, play on the words B2B. And it's where we're using all of our technology, you know, white labels, APIs, booking engines, things like that, partnering with other major travel companies to provide them with car rental solutions under their brand. You know, we launched our first airline partnership with Tiger Air last year. That was a big win for us. And so now every time you book a Tiger Air ticket, you're offered car rental in the booking path. And that's all powered by Vroom.
Fantastic. Mate, that's been really, really good. And thank you very much for your time. The last question, if people want to get hold of you, if people got other questions, for God's sake, don't give out your phone number here, but where's the best place for them to get in contact with you?
Yeah, well, with the amount of time I spend on airplanes, the phone number's the least likely to get me. So, you know, all the usual digital stuff. I've got a website at mikeboyd.com.au, and otherwise I like to hang out on Twitter, and I'm just at Mike Boyd. They're on Twitter as well. So you can email me through my website or send me a tweet or something. It'd be fantastic to connect with some of the audience.
Thank you very much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it. I hope a lot of people have got some insights from this because, you know, we could have done a part two for this and we could have gone on for another hour. But once again, mate, thank you very much for your time today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks again for having me and all the best with the future episodes too.
Thank you very much. It has been, as always, a total pleasure in bringing you this podcast episode. Once again, hopefully you get a chance to rate and review us on iTunes or give us a thumbs up or like on wherever else you happen to be listening to us. We'll hope to see you next week.